It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we talk with people who create films in Georgia. We'll go behind the scenes today with directors, writers, even a props assistant. So, as they say in the movies, roll it.
In a world plagued by zombies, overrun by superheroes, a world where Atlanta has been transformed into Yollywood, one woman is on a mission to tell the stories behind the names you only see after the movie. This is On Second Thought, with your host, Celeste Headlee.
The Georgia film industry is big business, $9.5 billion big in 2017. More than 320 movie and TV productions during this past year, including Stranger Things from Netflix, AMC's The Walking Dead, and a number of Marvel superhero films as well. One of the most successful projects predates all of those films. My Cousin Vinny premiered 25 years ago to critical and popular acclaim. Filmed mostly in Monticello, Georgia, it tells the story of an inexperienced New York attorney who takes on the biggest case of his career, a murder trial.
What kind of law do you practice?
Well, up till now, personal injury.
You're a trial attorney, right? I mean, personal injury trials.
Well, actually, this would be my first foray into the trial process.
That's actor Joe Pesci playing attorney Vinnie Gambini. This year, the Atlanta Film Festival paid tribute to My Cousin Vinny, and I spoke with its director, Jonathan Lynn. I want to play a clip real quick. This is actually about grits, and grits are about as southern as you can get. Let's take a listen to that scene.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Yeah, honey, you can try it.
You first.
Did you have any grit? Did you taste grits before you filmed this scene?
I have tasted grits, yes.
Did you like them? How do you eat your grits?
Well, I don't want to insult your audience, but it's not my favorite food, I have to say. I can appreciate, but then I don't like oatmeal either. Perhaps I'm just averse to that kind of...
bland breakfast food.
That kind of stuff, yes. But that's not the point. You don't have to try everything yourself in order to be able to direct a scene about it. Really, the thing about making a movie as a foreigner is that, unlike on stage, where you have to create the environment, the set, the ambiance, and everyone has to pretend to be something they're not, we went to the South. We actually went to Georgia to make the film, to Atlanta or Monticello, rather than Alabama, because Georgia has a film industry. But essentially, you go to where you're shooting, and it's what you are shooting. You don't have to have pretense. I went to a murder trial near Atlanta, and watched it for 3 or 4 days as part of my prep for the movie. And in fact, the courtroom that we built for the film is pretty much the same as the courtroom that I saw a real murder trial in. And I watched the whole procedure. I watched the way they selected the jury. I watched the behavior of the judges and the judge and the lawyers. And it's not that hard, whether you're a foreigner or an American, to shoot something that's there in reality. And then you have the advantage of American actors, you know, who know how to play those parts, who do understand the culture. So for me, it's all just a question of storytelling.
Let's take a listen to a scene from the film. We see several breakdowns throughout the movie of East Coast versus Southern dialect. Probably the most memorable exchange on that is in the courtroom between attorney Vinnie Gambini and Judge Haller. Here's Gambini examining a witness.
Is it possible... the two utes.
To what? What was that word?
What word?
To what?
What?
Did you say utes?
Yeah, two utes.
What is a ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
So, over the past 25 years, how has your, has your view of this film changed? I mean, how has it weathered for you?
my view of this film has improved, I think. At the time we finished it, it was a tremendous battle to get it out there. It was a not very expensive film, well below average budget.
Are you saying it was a battle to get enough press and attention to the film? Is that what you mean?
Oh, yes, it was. It was very hard to get the film to open. We didn't have recognized stars. We were opening around about the same, I think it was either the same week or the week before or after, Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts, which was causing a sensation. And it was very hard to get to encapsulate what made the film work so well. The studio, I think, were amazed when we did our first test screening because we got scores that went through the roof and the audience was euphoric about it. And, you know, it had not been a very important film in their schedule. And so there was the release date. They rethought. The release date was postponed by 3 or 4 months. And Joe Roth, who was chairman of the studio, did something really, I thought, daring and clever. He said, the only way we can sell this film is by showing it to people and getting good word of mouth. So they did, I think it was 900 screenings all over America, free screenings. And people came to them, and they got people in one way or another, and people came out of the screenings and talked about the movie, so that by the time we opened, there was great word of mouth.
Did that strategy worry you? Were you afraid the film wasn't going to make money?
You're always afraid that every film isn't going to make money. it was my third film, I didn't know such a lot about film marketing. I did know that they were right when they said the way people will be interested in this film is if their friends tell them to go see it. It was very hard to come up with a trailer that captured the mood and the sense of the film and how funny it is and how well it develops. But anyway, you asked me if my view of the film had changed over the years. I think I like it more as time goes by. I don't see it very often, but on the rare occasions that I've watched it, I've been pleased with the work we did. And I can't always say that about, you know, usually you look at your own work and you think, oh, I wish I'd changed this, or I wish I hadn't done that, or you know, you have all kinds of thoughts. I wish I'd cut that scene more strictly. You know, there's all kinds of things that you see that you can improve. And when I look at Vinny, I'm pleased with it.
Did you know that some teachers are using My Cousin Vinny as a teaching aid for young lawyers?
I did. I'm a recovering lawyer myself. I have a degree in law, and I was very keen that it should be legally absolutely accurate. But I was surprised about 15 years ago when I got invited to speak on a panel at a convention of judges, and it was something to do with the way Hollywood presents trials and the law, and I discovered that they all really loved My Cousin Vinny. Then I discovered that Justice Scalia, this was his favorite film.
Antonin Scalia, the former Supreme Court justice.
Yes, yes. So, you know, at least he got one thing right. And I do have a friend who's a federal judge in South Carolina who is a fan of this film to such an extent that he went to the Sack of Suds, which is the convenience store where the two boys were accused of stealing at the beginning of the movie and of murdering the clerk. And he went to the Sack of Suds and bought the sign. And it now hangs in his chambers.
A federal judge has the Sack of Suds sign in his chambers?
Yes. And he teaches evidence at various law schools. And he always uses My Cousin Vinny. And then this winter, I couldn't go, unfortunately, but I was invited to speak at a big convention in South Carolina by the retiring Chief Justice there, who it turns out is also an enthusiast about the movie. And it seems that they all regard it as the, I'm quoting them, you understand, this is not my opinion. They all say it's the most accurate film about a trial that's ever been made. It's the only film they've ever seen where there are no legal mistakes.
Wow.
I think that's the reason they like it so much, but of course I can't be sure. But I do know they use it as a teaching aid in law schools everywhere. I can't claim all the credit for that, you understand. I mean, I didn't write the script.
Yeah, this wasn't one of you.
Dale Lorna wrote the script.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have an unusual number of films in your repertoire that have become cult classics. And not just this one, but that people like to watch again and again and again. But there's also Clue. There's The Whole Nine Yards. Are you aware of something you're doing differently that makes something people still watch a movie and actually study a movie a quarter of a century later? Is that something that is conscious?
I don't know how to answer that because I ask myself that question. I'm constantly surprised at that several of my films seem to have acquired this sort of fanatical following. I get more emails and fan mail about Clue than I do even about My Cousin Vinny. And people seem to be absolutely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
It was my first film. That is a film I look at and see all kinds of things I should have done differently. But it's really nice that people still love it. The Whole Nine Yards, I think, works well. I'm pleased with The Whole Nine Yards. There's another film of mine that maybe my favorite, which was called Nuns on the Run, which is not shown here very much. It was a British movie with Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle, and made by Handmade Films, which was George Harrison's company.
But also Yes, Prime Minister, which is incredibly popular, and people still, Yes, Minister and Yes, Prime Minister, a TV series, but still a bit of cult classic.
They are. I don't know how to explain it.
which means if people come to you asking what your secret is, you don't know.
No, I have absolutely no idea. I just do what I think is funny and interesting. We all know that comedy is about timing, but the difference in the timing of a funny take and an unfunny take of exactly the same line or exactly the same moment is huge. A director's job really is to be the audience of one. You do all kinds of things. You make all kinds of suggestions to the writers, or sometimes if I'm the writer, to myself, to the camera people, to the actors, to everything. But finally, what you are is the audience. And you sit by the camera or stand by the camera and you watch a take and you think, did that work? And if it didn't work, you have to ask yourself, why not? Was it too slow? Was it too fast? Was the timing of that wrong? Was the thought not clear? You ask yourself every possible question and then you do it again. And when you think that works, you move on. And beyond that, I don't think I'm able to describe the process.
That's Jonathan Lynn, director of My Cousin Vinny. It came out 25 years ago and it was shot in Monticello, Georgia. Just ahead, we meet a props assistant who walks with the dead. But first, I'll talk with Atlanta-based producer Will Packer, whose film Girls Trip was one of the most successful comedies of the year. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we celebrate Georgia's film industry. One of the most successful animated shows is produced right here in Atlanta, not far from these studios where I'm sitting, actually, FX's Archer, centers around Sterling Archer, who is obsessed with a certain woman.
Lana? Lana? Lana!
What?
Lana Kane, the lead female character in the show, she and Archer have a love-hate relationship. Lana is voiced by actress Aisha Tyler, and we spoke earlier this year. So, the Lana Kane, the character herself, used to be, it looks like, from the storyline of the show, she started out as an activist and got recruited to be a spy straight from the protest line.
Yeah, I think Mallory Archer saw some kind of a kindred soul that day. For people who haven't seen the episode or who don't know the show, you know, Mallory Archer is Sterling's mother. She runs a spy agency. She, a clandestine, well, all spy agencies are clandestine. This is clandestine even from other clandestines. And she meets Lana when she's kind of a, you know, this hyper-intellectual college activist. And she's also an anti-fur protester. And she goes to throw blood on Mallory's fur coat.
Fur coat, yeah.
I might have been red paint. And they have this kind of standoff where, you know, Mallory, who's, you know, killed men for less, threatens Lana, and Lana doesn't blink. And in that moment, they fall in a very specific and moderately platonic kind of love, and Mallory recruits her to become a spy.
Yeah, although she sees
She sees a deadness in Lana's eyes that she connects with.
The lack of spark. And yes. I don't know if Lana knew how to fight before she joined, or she was just a really good study, but she is the one that actually is often the most lethal. Take a listen.
Our agents are highly trained in many disciplines. Like Krav Maga.
My arm! You're breaking my arm!
I'm sorry, did that hurt?
Do you think of Lana as a feminist character?
Oh, 100%. And I think of her as a feminist in the most modern sense of the word, in the sense with the most clarity. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of dogma in any kind of like movement, but I think, you know, Lana is a progressive in some ways. She's, you know, maybe, well, I mean, in the beginning, I think we talked about her, Adam Reed and I, the creator of the show, as a kind of a closet Republican. So, you know, she has these kind of progressive ideals, but she also is potentially an economic conservative and a social liberal. So she's complex. And I think that is the embodiment of the modern feminist, which is that women are not a monolith. But I think at her best, at kind of her core, she's just a self-determining woman, and she wants what she wants, and she pursues it with vigor and aggression. I mean, everything from being, you know, essentially the only senior spy at this agency other than Mallory, having her eye on the chairwomanship of this organization, being in the field with all the other men, being a better spy than all the other men, and also eventually becoming a single mother on her own, you know, by choice. She's just, you know, she embodies the idea, the feminist idea, that everyone should be the architect of their own destiny and also kick a lot of butt.
She does kick a lot of butt. And she also has almost a perfect foil to sort of express her own individuality and strength in Sterling, who is not quite as progressive. Here's another clip.
Baby crazy?
That's why I dumped her.
I dumped you because you're dragging around a 35-year-old umbilical cord!
See?
So how much of the dialogue is printed? How much do you get to play around with it?
These scripts come to us in perfect, immaculate condition. I mean, there's never a need to embellish because the writing is so brilliant. Sometimes Adam gives us opportunities to improvise, you know, hey, ad lib something here. But the show, as you see it, it springs wholly formed from the brilliant mind of Adam Reed. And I think none of us ever come in thinking we know better than him.
I wanted to ask about your reaction, I mean, which at this point has to be getting old, when your credentials as a nerd are questioned. The entry into nerdism and geekism seems to, for some people, be limited.
And reserved for men and reserved and precluded for people of color? Sure.
Yeah. Does that get old when you go to these cons?
Yeah, I mean, it's tiresome. I don't get outraged by it. You know, I think that when you are an excluded group, you can develop this kind of, I don't know what the actual term for it is, but when a group is hazed and then they return and haze as viciously or even more viciously the group that follows. But I think you have a group of people that's been excluded for most of their lives, and they finally have something that they feel is theirs, and they don't see that they're employing the same kind of exclusive strategies that were used against them when they were growing up. They're not even always aware of it. But it doesn't affect me personally because it is who I am. It's not a choice that I made. And I had Seth Green on my podcast several years ago, Girl on Guy, and we were talking about kind of taking on the mantle of nerdery. And he said, you can't call yourself a nerd if you didn't spend a significant amount of your childhood playing alone. And so by that litmus test, you know, I should be reserving a cape of some kind or a crown, because I mean a big part of my childhood was playing in my backyard alone, playing on my playground alone, reading on the bus for hours until I missed my stop and had to be collected from the turnaround lot. I was a very isolated kid socially, and I was a big reader, and I had glasses, and I was the only black kid in my school. I mean, at the time that. You know, that felt like a pariah state. You know, I was lonely, but it was everything that made me who I am today. So when people challenge it, it doesn't matter to me, because it's like telling me that, you know, I don't know that you know, you're not nearsighted. Well, I am nearsighted, and I wear contact lenses. And no matter how many times you say it, it's not going to undo the fact that I can't see a thing when I get out of bed in the morning. You know, so those challenges, they're meaningless.
So I have to ask you this about Wikipedia, which I always scan before I do an interview. And the reason I scan it is because you often find weird stuff in there, and I don't know how it arrived. So I have to ask you this, because Wikipedia makes it sound like you would never have gone into acting were it not for your crush on Sam Rockwell. Because they say you followed him into an improv class and basically never left.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And who knows if I would have gotten into acting or not. My mother says I was always this kind of presentational ham. I think I was a subtle and thoughtful, tiny intellectual. But, you know, we can dispute that on an ongoing basis. That is a true story. And when I interview people on my podcast and I ask them how they got into acting, I will tell you that 95% of them say it's because of a girl or a boy. Sam and I are still very, very close friends to this day, and he makes a little cameo in my first film. So,
did you ever date him?
Yes, we did. We dated. Oh, yeah. Oh, look at me. Of course we dated.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking.
For no reason other than curiosity, we dated.
We'll see. There you go. You got to get it out of the way. You got to rule it out. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with actress Aisha Tyler. She voices Lana Kane on the animated show Archer, which is made right here in Atlanta. So this is probably going to be another weird question I have to ask you, because there's one thing that Lana's really well known for on the show, and it's these long rants. Here's an example.
So
what? Anxious about a half-drunk first time driving a submarine idiot taking me to the bottom of the ocean to face 40 eco-terrorists led by a crazy person who's about to bomb the entire East Coast with nerve gas?
I was gonna say...
What? What were you gonna say?
So, does it hurt your voice? Do you have to do stuff to protect your voice?
I love how practical of a question that is. It does hurt my voice. And in fact, sometimes we'll save those rants or the screams for the end of the show, because I don't have a delicate voice, but it just is under an additional amount of pressure than most people experience. On, you know, I work on a talk show where I'm required to talk for a living, and then I do Archer, which requires a lot of talking, and then when I'm doing my podcast, that's 90 minutes typically of conversation. So it just is strained more than most voices. And I have come out of Archer sessions virtually hoarse, like having coming out with kind of laryngitis, no voice at all. So we try to kind of be strategic about how we do those scenes. And I think if you listen back to some episodes of Archer, I can't tell you which ones because I clearly have a terrible memory. There are some where I am barely able to speak, and I'm kind of forcing it out, which is fine. I mean, you know, I'm a vocal athlete. I can get through it. But she's a demanding lady, Lana Kane.
So what is the difference? What's the difference in the job itself between doing the voiceovers? And you've also done voiceovers for video games like Halo.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference in the acting itself between that, where you have only your voice, and just doing a regular scripted show?
That's a good question. I find kind of the work I do to be kind of performance decathlon. You know what I mean? Like every aspect of being an actor, in the same way that every aspect of being an athlete, they're complementary. So I don't think about them as being really different, but just kind of different facets of the same job. But it is much more, in some ways, technical when you're just using your voice, because you've got to create a feeling for the person who's listening that is more you know, you've got one tool to do multiple jobs, which is to give them a sense of character, a sense of place, experience. You're trying to interact with people who you're not actually speaking with. You know, I don't want to dismiss the other acting work I do because I think it's all challenging. But when you've got other people in the room and you've got props and you've got wardrobe on, you're able to kind of relax into the moment in a way because there are other things doing some of your job for you. But with your voice, you've got to accomplish a lot with just sound.
So, you know, you'll get into relationships and in like the third or fourth date, you'll start predicting whether that relationship will last.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you do the same thing with your acting projects. And if you do, if you thought Archer would make it to season 8.
Well, first of all, I go into every acting relationship thinking that it's doomed. And it's going to end with me standing in the street burning a pile of clothes with kerosene. So, yeah, you know, you go. Every actor goes into this job thinking this is all going to end terribly for me. Nothing's ever going to go. Nothing's ever going to work. I'm going to be fired during the dress rehearsal. With Archer, I didn't even think it was going to get ordered. So this has been 8 years of gravy, quite honestly, because I remember reading the script and thinking this is too smart, too funny, too dirty, too literate to ever, ever get on television. And so every single season when we've got picked up again, it's always a delight and a surprise. And I'm so proud of this show. I mean, I'm just thrilled to have been a part of it in any way.
That's Aisha Tyler, actress, and the voice of Lana Kane on the animated FX show Archer. Its 8th season premiered this year. Netflix had a spectacularly successful Georgia-produced debut series this season, Stranger Things. The second season premiered in October to a massive following. The people behind the scenes play a vital role in the show's success. Taraja Ramses is an on-set dresser for the show. He's been a part of Georgia's film and television industry for years. We caught up with him at his workshop in Atlanta at work on set pieces for Stranger Things.
This is like an artist's warehouse where a bunch of artists rent out different spaces. I use it mostly for storage, but sometimes I build a set here and shoot something of my own, or I usually just keep all my art equipment here. And so I got right here, I got about 30 or 40 flats. I put them up sometimes, paint them, strip them, and you know, do it again. And I also got a lot of props. And here I got like breakaway glass, paint, and everything I need for as far as art department, special effects and stuff like that. And these are all my tools. I'm right now getting my kit together. I got an on-set job for Stranger Things coming up. My main kit in my hands because I'm always moving furniture. And after that comes my cleaning kit because I always either have to clean something up, wipe down a window, or you know, make something nice and pretty. Sometimes, like on a show like Walking Dead, I got to make it dirty. So I also got like dirt I keep with me and other little special sprays and adhesives and I've got a mobile art department, so I can pretty much do anything with my cart. I got a blowtorch, you know, in case I gotta light a million candles in about 30-second period, which I had to do on a show called Revolution. After every take, I'd have to blow out the candles and light them up again. And so, after wearing my thumb out on a hand lighter, I went and bought a blowtorch, and that saved my life. It's my army box full of sockets and different tools. You know, on a day-to-day basis, I'll figure out what I need because sometimes we might just be at a river all day and I might not have to do anything. Or we might be in a jail cell and I gotta, you know, make it dirtier. And I'll keep my dirt spray. If something is too clean, I'll just make it look dirty. And I also got my little paint pump. Yeah, I'll make a little mixture of like a paint color and I'll spray it on like a wall or something. You know, everything is make-believe this business that we work in is make-believe, so you got to be able to, you know, roll with the punches and make it up as you go. And I pick up influences wherever I go. I try to learn from whoever I meet. And I've met a lot of people here in Atlanta that have taught me so much. And I'm here where I am now just from the people that I've learned from. Carl Johnson was a... He's an electrician that worked here in Atlanta. Dude, he's legendary here in Atlanta. He worked on pretty much every project here in Atlanta. He passed away last year, but you know, he mentored so many black filmmakers here in Atlanta. You know, so many people were given opportunities because of Carl Johnson. When I first started on-set dressing, I probably used to be maybe the only black guy on set outside of maybe one electrician or, you know, it was probably maybe one in every other department. But now I'm seeing an influx of, you know, ethnicities and stuff, especially even the more Hispanic people, and seeing more Asians, and I'm seeing more women behind the camera now, which is, you know, almost unheard of a lot back in the day. More, you know, black women behind camera, you know, as far as being directors and producers and actual, like, camera department. You know, it's getting more diverse, you know, as the days go by, which I think is a good thing. You know, and hopefully, you know, the art will start reflecting the diversity of the people behind the camera.
That's Atlanta-based on-set dresser Taraja Ramses. His many credits include Stranger Things, and that returned for its second season in October. Just ahead, translating actual war into fictional conflict for the movies. But first, I talk with filmmaker Will Packer about his hit movie, Girls Trip. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We are spending this hour looking back at some of our great talks with people who work in Georgia's film industry. We talked about women's growing prominence in major film and TV projects. Hello, Wonder Woman. L'Oreal Broussard of Women in Film and Television Atlanta says films starring women often do well where it counts.
It always starts from the top down, and that means like at your big studios in Los Angeles and even the ones here in Atlanta. They're always thinking, of course, of the bottom line and the financials. But one thing that you've seen this year and the past 2 years, that just even with female leads and diverse female leads in films, those films have made the most money, you know, at the box office.
And Girls Trip is no exception. It cost $19 million to make, and this year it grossed more than $130 million. I spoke with Atlanta-based producer Will Packer, who worked on that film.
Hey, Celeste, what's happening?
Not much. Well, let's talk about Girls Trip.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so proud of that movie. So cool. Such a good time.
You know,
like making it and seeing the release of it.
And I want, you know, I went to see the release of it, and audiences are loud.
They are. Yes, they are.
When they see this movie.
They're having a good
time. Which kind of adds to the experience.
You go with the right audience. It's a party in the theater. You go to one of those theaters that serves drinks, and you get the ladies with the wine. They are having a ball. I love it. Mission accomplished.
You must get a ton of pitches and scripts given to you. How do you know a good script from a bad one?
You have to have a vision and a plan for the type of content you're looking for and that you want to make, and you have to stick to that. And, you know, I am fortunate that I'm in a position where I do get a lot of content. You know, very rarely do I meet somebody that doesn't have either. The thing about me is when I meet people, it's either they have an idea for a movie or they have an amazing kid. Like, that's all I get. Like, it's just, like, and I guess sometimes before the person starts talking, I'm like, okay, this one has got the cute kid. You know, I can just tell, or no, this has got the true story that they're going to pitch me. But that's what I get all the time. So the good thing about that is that I am exposed to a lot of different creative ideas, and some of them are really good. And for me, I have to think about, okay, what is the type of content that I want to make? I feel like I have a responsibility to do content well and do content that does have certain imagery. And I also have an economic imperative to make content that is commercial. You try to get that sweet spot of commercial and critical acclaim, which we got with Girls Trip, which is awesome. And so, yeah, that's kind of my approach to, you know, kind of figuring out, wafting through, you know, all the pitches and ideas to find stuff that is a Will Packer project.
So an interesting thing is that when people are talking about this movie and previous successes that you've had.
Yes.
They're talking about how good you are at targeting a specific audience. And in this case, I assume they mean targeting a black female audience. Mm. Is that your goal? Because when I was at the theater, there was all kinds of people.
Everybody,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's when you really win. You know, I think more than ever, audiences are not segregating themselves, I think. And we as filmmakers have to be aware of that and make content accordingly. I have always tried to make content that felt inclusive, not exclusive. That even though it may be specific in the characters, it may have been made through a particular lens, it may thematically be specific to, you know, a particular culture, but feels universal. I try to make sure that I make projects that have universal themes and entry points. That's so important. So, Girls Trip, there are four black women in the leads of that movie, and they are behaving in the way that some black women behave. And they're doing it in a really natural, authentic, organic way, and we did a great job capturing that. Now, that doesn't mean that it's just for black women and that non-black women can't enjoy the film. And in fact, as you point out, they have been enjoying the film. That's the balance. As a filmmaker, you know, movies that have been starring white people have been made forever, and non-white people have been going to the movies, you know, partially because that's the only movies that were made for a long time, but also because, you know, they just accept majority culture and they enjoy it. And, you know, Will Ferrell and, you know, Amy Schumer are funny. So you go to those movies, no matter whether you look like them or not. I think the same thing is now starting to be true about Regina Hall and Queen Latifah and Tiffany Haddish and Jada Pinkett Smith.
So let's hear from another one of your movies that people have probably heard of, and that's Straight Outta Compton. In this particular clip, the crew is getting their they've been patted down, and they're being harassed by local police, and the manager's not happy about that.
Get down! Get on the ground! Now!
We're trying to check these bangers, make sure they're clean.
All right, I'm sorry. These are not bangers. These are artists.
What kind of artists?
Rappers. And they're working with me in the studio right now.
Well, see, rap is not an art. And I'm sorry, who are you?
I'm the manager.
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like.
But that's police harassment.
So it's kind of this cliche in Hollywood, right, that somebody will say, well, I'm doing this cheesy bad movie because I want to be able to afford to do art. but then you look at something like Straight Outta Compton, where you seem to have this sense of where those two intersect.
Yeah.
So how far do you need to get into a script before you know you found it?
Well, you know what? I think that, you know, Straight Outta Compton was obviously a biopic, so it's a little bit of a different approach. And F. Gary Gray did an amazing job. That was, you know, the project he was born to direct. So with a biopic, you're trying to be true to the story, the people involved. You know, you're creating art around true events, which is a whole different challenge and requires a different skill set. But at the end of the day, if you're true to what the story is and it happens to be commercial, then you win. So you don't take license just to make it commercial when you're telling a true story, in my opinion.
There's some biopics that are really deadly dull and boring though, because they've stayed too true.
Yeah, and that's the balance. I mean, I would argue probably those biopics did not need to be told in that medium. You know, it rarely do I meet somebody that doesn't think their story is a TV show or a movie. And the reality is that that's just not the case. You know, all true life stories are not created equal. That's just the harsh reality of it. Very rarely do I hear, and they're interesting stories. I always get pitched like the first, you know, the first person to do this, the first person to do that. And that's great. And I want like that to be something that, you know, my kids know, you know, and that they can learn about. And maybe that's something I can put out on a digital format or in other short form content. But it doesn't mean in today's environment that people will be willing to go and sit in a theater and watch that film.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Atlanta-based filmmaker Will Packer. His movie Girls Trip is showing in theaters nationwide. Let's talk about Kevin Hart.
Okay.
You were one of the first people to really recognize the potential there, and it's now, again, a running joke at Kevin Hart getting pretty much every role that there is for the funny sidekick. So first, let's hear a little bit. This is from the movie Ride Along, again, a huge success that you produced. Kevin Hart and Ice Cube catch up to the criminal at last that they've been chasing.
What you doing? Hey, how stupid are you to hide out in the same place we found you before, Jay?
Plain sight, classic tack, man. You better tell me where that Serbian buy is going down, boy, or I'm gonna give you a classic captain.
Ain't telling you nothing.
Or you going to jail with a bullet wound.
You think he playing with you? You think he got time for games? This man is crazy. He pulled a gun out, that means he's serious.
What makes Kevin Hart so good on film?
Kev is he's a unique talent. You know, he has an ability to self-deprecate, to use what other people have perceived as a negative as a positive. You know, he's short. His demeanor, stature works it for his advantage. He also has been around for a while, so he's honed his act. Like, you know, it's interesting, you know, when you said that I was one of the people to help bring him to prominence, that is a true statement, but he'd been around for a while. And when I was talking to people about Kevin Hart for Think Like a Man, you know, some of the pushback I got from other studios outside of Sony, where I eventually made it, was, yeah, we know Kevin Hart, you know, he's not a star. He's had movies, you know, he made Soul Plane and that tanks. He had a sitcom that failed. He's been around for a while. He should just be, you know, supporting actor. He's not a leading man. And now, of course, all those studios will pay big dollars to have him in their films. I think that all those years of working and working and grinding and grinding and being told, you know, he was, you know, to this, to that, not enough this, not enough that, he's used to his advantage. He has honed, you know, his voice to the point where now it's being received in a big way, really around the world.
So another thing you're really well known for, and a lot of people have said about you, is how calm you are on the set. And also that you're very good at working with big egos.
Egos. Yes. Welcome to Hollywood.
How do you do that? How do you work with an outsized ego?
You know, this is a very, this is an industry that feeds those beasts. This is an industry that rewards bad behavior. It creates adversarial conditions often. That's what happens, you know? You got a lot of people that are yellers and screamers and big personalities, type A personalities. And I'm a type A personality. I'm very aggressive and I'm very confident. But I know how to be even keeled. I know how to approach things in a way so that I don't get too high or too low. You have to maintain that. My opinion, to be successful in this business, has worked very, very well for me. While everybody else is screaming and running around and yelling fire, I'm looking for the hose, you know what I mean, to put it out.
So you have, for your entire career, I mean, it sounds to me like you launched in this career, even going back to the $20,000 Florida film.
Oh boy, yes, Chocolate City that, at FAMU.
Yeah, Florida you had A&M. This goal to create movies that African Americans could see themselves in,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Over all that period of time, we haven't seen a lot of give in Hollywood else, right? In other production companies, we've seen that the diversity of actors and directors and producers, there's not been a huge amount of progress there. Why, as the decades go by, does that not change?
Well, I think it has changed, but I think that what you're speaking to speaks to how far we had to go, right? So, in other words, it's like if we're running a race and you start off 10 miles ahead of me, and then we look back 5 years and you're 5 miles ahead of me, you're still way too far ahead of me. But it's because I had so far to catch up. So there's been progress. But there was such a dearth of you know, African-American filmmakers and storytellers, and really of color, minority groups.
Anyone not white male.
White males have run it for a very long time. And so, you know, power seeds nothing without demand.
That's Atlanta-based filmmaker Will Packer. For many people who work in Georgia's film industry, this work was something they always wanted to do. That's not the case for Bradley Field, though. He's a veteran who eventually went to Hollywood working security and then moved into the accounting department. His credits include Suicide Squad, Detroit, and Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night. Son of Krypton versus Bat of Gotham.
We caught up with Bradley just after production wrapped in Atlanta on Den of Thieves. That's due out next year.
So I come from the military side of things, actually. I spent 12 years in the Army. I was in the CAV, Combat Arms. Got out of the military, joined the film industry as a security consultant. Real actual job title is called Confidentiality for Warner Brothers and DC Films. I was trying to stop all the paparazzi and the fanboys from getting all the good juices and intel stuff. Essentially, what had happened was security was a little lax in Detroit. That's where they did the bulk of the filming for Batman Superman. So the locations manager had an idea of bringing in a guy with military background to be as kind of a consultant, in which that turned out being me. Through the workings of the VA, we found each other. So I came in for his consulting, and then it turned into like a full-time job where I actually had a team. We were basically an upscale security for the movie, which a lot of productions hadn't really seen before. And our job was strictly to protect the intellectual property, suits, plot points, scripts. When we were on the streets, make sure the paparazzi couldn't get the shots they wanted to, using different blocking measures with trucks and tarps and all kinds of stuff so they couldn't get anything out. Policing up the extras. We had a lot of extras on that movie. Making sure they had the right credentials, the right people, and making sure they had all signed the confidentiality agreements, NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, that kind of stuff. My time in the military and the time overseas and meeting all kinds of different people and running all kinds of different operations helped me out in this industry. I worked with a lot of big names on the DC movies. If I had to choose one, I'd say Will Smith was pretty awesome. The job I was doing, it was very militarized. The guys I had, we all had the combat boots and 5'11" tactical pants, and it was very tactical. So every time he'd walk by, he'd send me a little salute. We were down on location in Toronto, and we were switching sets. We were down in an alleyway, and then the next shot was going to be up on top of a building across the street. Now, normally for my job is we would put a robe over him so nobody could get any pictures of him, blah, blah, whatever. But Will being Will said, "Nah, I'm going to run it." So he takes off and sprints across the street with, not really anybody knowing. So then I'll go with him. And it kind of turned into a race. We hit the building next door, and it's a 7-story building. Elevator's taking a while, so he goes, "All right, let's do this. Take up the stairs." So then it becomes a race up the stairs, 7 stories. So that was pretty fun. I think the film industry and the military are set up a lot of ways very similar to each other. Coming to this industry where you see so many people who are in love with film, and they want to just make movies and they want to be part of something special, and then you see other people who are doing it just because it's the money's out there and they want to be, they want just the glamour and they don't care who they run over to get there. That was the question when I first came in. Where do I want to go from there? Because after coming, except from the military, and then being introduced to this new world, I was talking about, we were cool. We were talking with all stunt guys, talking with the drivers, talking with some of the ADs who are aspiring directors, and just seeing, it's really just an eye-opener to seeing this world.
Turns out the military world is pretty good preparation for Hollywood make-believe. Having worked on several superhero films, Bradley admits he has one regret.
I spent 2 years of my life around the Batmobile, like literally around the Batmobile. I could have had so many pictures of myself in it, messing around. I never once stepped foot in it when I wasn't supposed to. And I have producers who, the people who told me that it's my whole mission is to keep anybody from getting a picture of the Batmobile, and here they are, and they're doing it. I never did anything like that.
And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. What is your favorite movie of the year? That's different from best film. Remember, your favorite movie. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk. Our special program on Georgia's film industry was produced by Sean Powers, and special thanks to Kalina Baller of the Credits Podcast. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.